Welcome to our second class in this sacred conversation about death, which is also, of course, a conversation about life. I have to say that I'm personally blown away, as many of you have shared, by the depth of personal experience and wisdom that's coming through, and also with how many layers of experience and spirit each one of you is bringing to this journey. I sometimes have had the sense that this listserv is a kind of orchestra, and that your insights and stories and your shared emotions and feelings are making a kind of musical tapestry that actually expands all of us so that we can, as individuals and as a sangham, hold more awareness and freedom in the midst of all this. We're all a little raw and vulnerable, and I include myself, because preparing and teaching this class has, you know, is putting me in touch with the very, very powerful energies that come into play as we begin to discuss these realms. They're energies of great beauty and great sacredness and also great power. And I also want to say that part of what I'm experiencing and many of us are experiencing is tuning into the kind of held recognitions of our previous dying, the recognitions that are layered into ourselves, both from the losses of this lifetime and from the losses of past lives. And as Swarupa wrote so beautifully yesterday, we're also carrying the pain of humanity's apparent and real failures to evolve past greed and selfishness and cruelty, and also the collective goodness that humanity has been able to manifest, which is just as real, though perhaps more fragile. And what part of what we're doing here together is metabolizing all this and also standing up for the best in ourselves and standing up for the active form of hope, what we could call the mature hope that we carry going forward. So welcome to this transformative process, which sometimes feels like a big fire, sometimes feels like a dark night, and sometimes feels so graceful and fruitful and loving that I want to dance because the possibilities are so great. Thank you for accepting the invitation and for being willing to go where it takes you. And also, I just want to express my utter confidence that the opportunity we're being presented with is especially great because of the grace that surrounds us here and in the weeks to come. So today we will begin discussing some of the yogic teachings that are core to this conversation. We'll do a lot of practice, a series of deep meditations. We will, God willing, have time for questions. And so now let's find our seats. If you're sitting someplace where you can do that, close your eyes. Take a comfortable seat. Let's all start by sitting up, though there will be a meditation later on, which you can do in Shavasana. And let's begin by feeling into the sense of this community. Imagine us spread around the world, our souls like flames on six continents. And tuning into your own heart, just let yourself have a sense of the hearts that are present in all of us. And then imagine a candle, maybe a tea light, maybe a big elaborate candle. Kindle a flame and place the candle in the center of the circle. We ask that our practice and contemplation be of benefit to all living beings, both sentient and insentient, including ourselves and all those whose lives we personally touch. We ask that our highest aspirations bear fruit. We ask that our meditations and contemplations give us access to the sacred joy that lies beyond suffering. So we'll continue by chanting the Mahamrityunjaya Mantra, Triambakam Mantra. We'll chant along with Yogi Hari, who sings it very beautifully. And then we'll chant the Om Namah Shivaya Gurave invocation with the help of Krishna Das, and go into our first meditation. So if you have your chant sheets, all the better. Otherwise, just listen.
Om Trayambakam Yajamahe Sugandhim Pushtivardhanam Purvarukam Vabandhanan Mrityor Mukshiyamam Ritat. Om Trayambakam Yajamahe Sugandhim Pushtivardhanam Purvarukam Vabandhanan Mrityor Mukshiyamam Ritat. Om Trayambakam Yajamahe Sugandhim Pushtivardhanam Purvarukam Vabandhanan मृत्योर्मुक्ष्यामृतात् ॐ त्र्यम्बकं यजामहे सुगन्धिं पुष्टिवर्धनं उर्वारुकमिव बन्धनान् मृत्योर्मुक्ष्यामृतात् ॐ त्र्यम्बकं यजामहे सुगन्धिं पुष्टिवर्धनं उर्वारुकमिव बन्धनान् मृत्योर्मुक्ष्यामृतात् ॐ त्र्यम्बकं यजामहे सुगन्धिं पुष्टिवर्धनं उर्वारुकमिव बन्धनान् मृत्योर्मुक्ष्यामृतात्
Be present with your posture, really feeling the connection of your sits bones and the heaviness of your buttocks and thighs against the seat. Feel how with the next exhaled breath, you can allow the breath to begin uncoiling your spinal column upward. Your shoulder blades release onto the back. Your chest lifts and opens. And with your next inhalation, you begin to become present to the vertical channel that runs just in front of the spinal column. The breath flows in and down the channel towards the base. It flows out with the exhalation upward through the belly, the heart, the throat, the head, up to the crown. Have the sense that the inhalation flows in with Namaha, the mantra of honor, reverence, and surrender. The exhalation flows with Shivaya. And as the last syllable echoes at the end of the exhalation, feel that as you let go into the space beyond Shivaya, that the distractions, the worries, the thoughts that have been coming and going during the day are offered up into that spaciousness. Namah with the inhalation, Shivaya with the exhalation, feeling into that Yah sound at the end of Shivaya, within which forms naturally release for a moment into pure space. Namah Shivaya, the breath flowing in through the crown and down towards the base. The exhalation flowing upward, merging with the Yah in the space above the head. And with the next inhalation, allow Namah to flow into the heart and Shivaya to expand the heart. The inhalation flowing into the heart from above, the exhalation expanding the heart. Namah Shivaya. Everything is offered into that fundamental auspiciousness that's the ground of life and death. And in offering, we receive it all. And when you're ready, you can open your eyes. It's not necessary. Some of you will do this entire class with your eyes closed. And I also want to welcome this storm that is, I guess we could say, raging outside my house in Northern California. The wind whipping around and the wind chimes jangling and singing. It's really great. In his wonderful recent book, The Five Invitations, which has joined a series of really stellar books that Buddhist-trained hospice workers like Joan Halifax Roshi have contributed, the author, whose name is Frank Ostaseski, who's the founder and former teacher of the Zen Hospice Project in San Francisco, shares five truths, instructions, that are really helpful as we contemplate not just death, but also the little deaths that we experience in life. So today we're just going to work with the first two. The first one is don't wait. Start now. And of course, that's the fundamental yogic recognition. It's the one that makes all our inner work possible, especially when it comes to working with the issues around loss. There's a yogic dictum. My guru used to say it, and I've read it in quite a few places. I think it comes from the Dharma Shastras, actually, the Indian books on conduct and how to live a good life. It says, do today what you intended to do tomorrow. Do tomorrow what you intended to do next week. Very good advice for natural procrastinators, of whom I must admit I'm one. So we start working with the practices for dying right now, and we use the situations that come up day to day to help us do it. And what could be a better way to live, especially at the times when life feels tough, but even when the times when it doesn't. So the second invitation, which is a hint about the kind of practice that we might be doing now, is welcome everything, push away nothing. Welcome everything, push away nothing. Now, most of us have heard that instruction maybe a few times, maybe in the form of that famous Rumi poem, which is shared all over the internet and which I get sent to me at least 5 times a year, and it's a fabulous poem. I bet you know what I'm talking about. This is part of it. This being human is a guest house. Every morning a new arrival, a joy, a depression, a meanness. Welcome and entertain them all, even if they are a crowd of sorrows. The dark thought, the shame, the malice, meet them at the door, laughing, and invite them in. Be grateful for whatever comes, because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. So this is one of those practices that will take you through pretty much every situation. And it's actually quite hard to practice. And, right, it's kind of hard to practice under some situations, under some circumstances. And, of course, that's why being willing to commit ourselves to some immediate practices for facing the small deaths, as well as the bigger ones, the losses, the grief, the regrets, the fear and anger that mark all transformations. And the big key, really, to dying is about letting go into whatever it is that's going on. And the art is in figuring out and practicing how we do it. So I want to just say something about that, what I think is one of the big cons about life right now. Because when we think about the collective, the train wrecks that are piling up in various places in the world, including the political situation in the United States, it's easy to feel powerless, grief-stricken, and kind of desperate to do something. And it's equally easy, I've found, to get overly fascinated by these stories. As a person with a background in political, I come from a family of journalists who were political junkies, and those some scars are very deeply in me, and I do get riveted by all this. But one of the ways we lock ourselves both into our karmic patterns in this life and the stored karmic patterns of the past is by paying so much attention to stories. And I don't mean only our personal stories, but also to the collective stories. And, of course, particularly the negative stories, though the Pollyanna stories aren't so helpful either. But it's a delicate dance. Because one of the ways that the world evolves and changes is by the attention we give to making change where it's needed, to calling out injustice, to helping people, to every form of active and subtle activism. So we live with a koan, realizing that we do have a responsibility not to turn away, to do what we can, both in action and in giving blessing, both for ourselves and for the collective field, simply because every one of us who makes effort to act without attachment to personal agendas makes it easier to repair the broken world. In the Jewish tradition, which is all about human obligation to fix the world, to repair the world, there's a famous saying that humanity is held together by 9 righteous people. Of course, the original text says righteous men, but we know better. Especially these days, we know that at least half of them are women. And so that's a big karmic obligation that each of us discharges as best we can, moment to moment. And yet at the same time, for the sake of our freedom, really the most important thing we can do in the day-to-day is to practice letting go, including letting go of our sense of tragedy, of the stories that trigger our accumulated pain, and that ultimately will prevent us from getting free of the entanglements of our own karmas. I'm saying this not to be heavy and not to guilt trip you if you have a hard time letting go, because you're definitely not alone, but just to offer you the deep truth that this is kind of the big secret of living and dying. And the whole, you know, the gift of contemplating dying and is that it starts to show us all the ways we die in life, which can be interpreted in many ways because, of course, in one sense, we die every night when we go to sleep. But a lot of it is about being able to let go and keep the heart open to maintain as much awareness as we're capable of and to realize that some things we just can't see. To keep the heart open, to surrender into the losses, it's such a widely taught truth that it's almost become a cliche. And certainly for us yogis, it's kind of a truism. And yet, it's hard to do. I remember having a conversation with my mother, who was agonizing over something that one of her relatives was doing that she felt was dangerous and destructive and that she was really worried about. And I was in my hardcore yoga swami phase at the time. And I said, well, you just have to be more detached from all this. So she kind of yipped. And an hour later, she called me back. She said, what was that word you used? You mean detached? I said. She said, yeah, detached. I went blank when you said it. But I just realized it might be something important. And then we laughed because detachment is one of the harder things there is for a Jewish mother. So it's actually worth getting creative about our opportunities to exercise detachment. And I'm going to give you a few examples of, let's call it, creative ways and moments when we can do some of the detached practices. And then obviously we'll look at some small and some pretty big practices for letting go. So here's a place where you can creatively practice letting go. I've done this quite a few times myself. I consider myself an expert in this particular practice. When somebody you love leaves you, or when you feel they don't love you enough, take a moment to offer that person into the universe or into the heart of the goddess. Wish them well and then offer them again every time you feel grief about their passing. Or when you've made a sudden sharp recognition that you just made the same dumb financial mistake that you made last year at this time, take a minute to do a little inventory of what the sequence of events was. Notice that perhaps there was a moment when you could have made a different choice. Pray you don't do it again. But then surround yourself with accepting tenderness and breathe out the self-incrimination and shame. When you feel that rising flood of righteous anger and you know that you're going to scream or say something you'd rather not say, see if you can walk out of the room or go into the bathroom and feel the feeling, surround it with light or space, and breathe into the tight cluster of hot anger until you start to feel that it can actually be separated by the breath into particles. Might take a while, but stay there till you start to feel a little bit of opening. And when you get a really immediate darshan of your own failures of character, ask forgiveness, make amends where possible. We're going to talk about that later too. But surround yourself with compassion and acceptance, even as you try to do better. Because as Carl Rogers so brilliantly said, you have to accept yourself before you can change. And of course, to make the daily effort of offering your work and your hopes into the divine. And that includes the pain, physical and mental. And for me, the most important part of learning to let go, I don't think I could have done it, you know, just on the hoof, has been to constantly deepen my experience of what it is that we let go into. And that's why this practice of surrendering into the central channel and into the madhya are so incredibly important, and why our capacity for feeling the presence of helpful sacred beings and helpful sacred divine forces is so crucial in this journey. Many of you here have a practice, and many of you here have a really strong felt experience of sensing into non-dual awareness or into the presence of Shakti, the field of energy and grace within and behind experience. Some of you have been sharing the experience that when you surrender into really feeling what's going on in your emotional body, when you really surrender it, there's a field of bliss there. And part of what we're here doing is supporting each other and accessing that field. Not to say that there's anything wrong with you if in this moment you can't, to hold it for each other in those moments that we're capable of holding the field. In my experience, devotional practice, including deity practice, are a short path to recognition of that field of light and joy that is your deepest self. It's certainly not the only path, but it's pretty helpful, comparatively easy for people who have that kind of temperament and who are comfortable turning to personal deities or to a sense of enlightened beings or the idea that a form can be a vortex or a doorway into grace. So I highly recommend personal form practices like the one we did last week and we'll do again. You know, we're practicing with Shiva, but it could be goddess, it could be your teacher, it could be another being, it could be a great light, it could be your grandmother if contemplating your grandmother opens you to a sense of gracious presence. And many of you have shared that when we did the practice, there was no specific being. And and I want to say this is actually really important, especially for those of us who are perfectionists about practice. You don't have to know who you're contacting or even be good at visualization. The most important thing is to sense presence, to have a felt sense of tuning into the feeling of subtle, sacred, open presence with you. And as many of you know, the more we do this, the more those forms become real for us. Practice is the key, as the Yoga Sutras say. Practice performed again and again for a long time. And, of course, in the conversation that we're having, it's not the connections we form with higher presences are important not only because they inspire us in the day-to-day and give us energy and help us with our problems, They're also really helpful in facing into death. First of all, and we said something about this last week, most of the after-death literature confirms that when we die, we are met and escorted, and that whether our guides are personal or, you know, maybe past friends or parents or angels, or whether they're just a kind of general sense of well-being and being cared for, we are going to be accompanied in the after-death bardos by helpful presences. And one of the things I hope for you is that you learn to trust that. So I want to tell a guru story. In my tradition, and I think in many people's lineage traditions, there are a wealth of stories about this kind of thing. This is one I really love. So one of my guru's old stories was a man called Yende. I'm telling you the name so you can keep track of the characters. He brought his boss, who was a man named Vankede, to meet Muktananda. And the boss and Swami Muktananda had made a connection. And then the boss got very ill. And Yende got a call one day saying that his boss was dying. So he called Muktananda's ashram to ask that Muktananda pray for the soul of his boss. And he was told that Muktananda hadn't come out of his room all day and that he'd asked not to be disturbed. So Yende kept calling and calling and kept being told he couldn't leave a message. And finally he got in the car and drove the 90 kilometers from Mumbai to the ashram. And he arrived about 8 in the evening. And as he was coming in, he saw Swami Muktananda coming out of his door. And the first thing he said was, "You didn't have to tell me. I knew when Katie was going. That's why I didn't come out of my house today. I saw that he was dying and that he had done a lot of negative actions, so his hard karmas were obstructing his passage. But I was able to carry him past the obstacles, and now he'll have a good rebirth." And then he looked hard at the devotee, at Yende, and said, "This is why you have a guru, for this moment." Now, I want to tell you that you don't have to have a personal face-to-face relationship with a teacher or a great sage or guide to have this help when you pass away. And one reason we do this practice of becoming present to the being over our heads, which is called guru yoga or deity yoga in Tibetan, is because it's one of the most powerful ways there is not only to open the inner channels, but to kindle trust in personal presence. Often the field of grace, as I've said, that you're most familiar with is not personal at all, but a felt sense of awareness. And we're going to do some micro practice with that later on. But in the Tibetan Dzogchen tradition, which is a highly advanced tradition of meditation and awareness, those masters insist that in order to do that awareness practice successfully, we actually need to connect to divine beings, to deities or gurus. So let's again go into our Sushumna Nadi practice, and this time we'll practice with the personal form of Shiva. I want to say again that you may not visualize Shiva and you may decide to practice with a different energy, with a different being, but I am going to give instructions about what the light form of Shiva, the meditating yogi, looks like, so that those of you who want to do it as a visualization, even as an evocation, can follow that instruction. What appears, as we've said earlier, may not be a form. It may be something quite abstract. It might just be a feeling. But here we go. Find your posture. And once again, begin to allow the breath to flow vertically, feeling that the breath actually comes in through the crown and flows down the body as far down into the pelvic floor as is comfortable, and that the exhalation flows upward through this channel just in front of the spinal column. See if you can let yourself sense the sweep of the breath flowing in from above, exhaling upward from below. You may inhale with Namah, exhale with Shivaya. Or if this is more comfortable for you, inhale with a sense of light flowing down, or of presence or energy flowing down and flowing up with the breath. Now begin to imagine the presence over your crown of the yogi form that we call Shiva. This is how he looks. His form is made of very pale white light, which perhaps you may see as a pale blue. And it undulates in the form of a yogi, naked to the waist, wearing around his waist a tiger skin, sometimes an elephant skin. Very carelessly, he's arranged this around his lower body. His legs are in perfect lotus posture. His eyes are closed. His hair is piled on top of his head in dreadlocks. And a crescent moon is caught in his hair. His features are thin and chiseled. And in the center of his forehead is a vertical third eye, which is wide open, looking out into universes. Around his neck, he wears a cobra. And in his right hand, he holds a trident. The other hand is in chin mudra, thumb and forefinger touching, resting palms up in his thigh. He floats above your crown. Perhaps he's present in a form that's about your size, perhaps smaller, perhaps in a very large form. Perhaps he's just there as a sense of presence or light. And as you inhale, as you allow the inhalation to rise with Namaha, and as you allow the inhalation with Namaha is drawing streams of Shiva's light, his white light energy. It's flowing down from his own central channel through the region at the base of his spine. It's flowing down through your head, and you're inhaling it down to the base. And then with the exhalation, you offer Namah Shivaya back upward into this being above your crown. Your offering is a salutation. You're inhaling the light streams of grace and presence that is flowing to you from this being atop your crown. inhaling the flow of light from the presence above your crown, exhaling Namah Shivaya as an offering into that presence. And if thoughts are arising, or discomfort, or doubt, or anything, you can allow that too to flow with the exhalation and be offered into this vortex form of pure awareness that is Shiva. If the energy above your head feels too powerful, emphasize the inhalation and the flow of grace into your body. Allow the exhalation to be an offering. And simply keep inhaling that grace. With your next inhalation, draw the energy from above the crown into the heart. And with the exhalation, feel that it spreads through the whole chest area, down into the belly, and begins to enliven your physical body. And then you might like to bring your hands together in prayer position and draw them up above the crown. And then very slowly and gently flow them down around your body, creating a circle of containment for the energies that have opened. Shiva's name, Mrityunjaya, the one who triumphs over death, is also a way of referring to the fact that he holds us steady in the face of our fear of death. And as you know, that fear can be paralyzing when we first confront it. One of the reasons I spent a lot of time contemplating death is because my first recognition that I was going to die happened when I was 19, which is pretty old, actually. But since no one close to me had ever died, my reaction to the recognition which just came upon me in the middle of the night was absolute terror. I really had nothing in my background had given me any reason to believe in anything like an afterlife or anything like a protective being. And as I lay there shaking in fear and just praying that morning would come so I could get back to normal, I realized that this is something I was going to have to deal with, but for God's sake, not now. And it really wasn't until I had my first spontaneous awakening, which was about 10 years later, and started meditating and studying yoga philosophy, that I felt safe in facing death again. You know, even though secular scientists like Richard Dawkins dismiss religious practice as our immature human attempts to make sense of death, the truth is that we really do need those glimpses of the light or love or wisdom that arises when we practice over time. To know what the possibilities are. And, you know, even though religions are definitely human institutions and have given us some really bad information about what happens when we die and are, of course, as deeply flawed as all other human institutions, some of the truths that are part of them, especially the Eastern teachings, though I have to admit I'm prejudiced, are utterly subject to experience. You know, the laws of karma, the practices of yoga, and the experience we arises when we connect to higher powers. And I know that that higher power experience is utterly non-denominational. There's so many ways we do that. But when we know on some level that there are practices we can learn to settle the mind, kindle the heart, metabolize regrets and guilt, then the whole thing becomes workable and possible. I want to discuss a few of the fundamental yogic truths that make this conversation so significant. And the first one is about fear of dying. You know, fear of dying is embedded in our consciousness. It's apparently unique to human beings. The Yoga Sutras call this primal terror of death abhinavesha, and they tell us that it's one of the core kleshas, the obstructive, binding energies, really, that surround and cloud human consciousness like cloaks, and that are the root cause of all the bad feelings that we have in life. And abhinavesha, as some of you probably know and remember, is the final link in what is kind of scarily called the chain of bondage. because they are the major factors in the experience of human suffering and delusion. And I'm speaking now from the yoga tradition, the tradition of Sankhya and yoga. There's a similar chain in Vedanta, except there are two more links in it. But let me go through them very briefly. The most primal klesha is avidya, which means no, and vidya means knowledge or wisdom. So avidya is non-wisdom, and that means not having the wisdom to know what's real and what you are. And in Shaiva Tantra, which many of you have studied, there are said to be two forms of ignorance. One is primal ignorance, which is built into the system, which is the basic experience of separation that Shakti assumes when she begins the process of manifesting as a universe. That's why it's called primal. The other form of ignorance is what is called intellectual ignorance. And that form of ignorance is dispelled by study and repeated contemplation of the truth of who we are. But so primal avidya makes us feel small and especially makes us feel separate from the wholeness. And this naturally gives rise to the experience of being a particular me, which is called asmita, which literally means egoic I-ness. And it's, of course, that Velcro-like identification with our limited consciousness and then with the body and personality. And again, this is primal. Some of us have, you know, very egregious personality type egos. Others are more fluid and more, so to speak, advanced. But pretty much everybody in the normal state of things experiences asmita. And then once you identify yourself as a me, you naturally begin to seek. And what we seek are the things that feel good or advantageous or that we think will feel good to the separate me, and try to avoid what feels unpleasant or difficult or painful. And these two qualities, which in Sanskrit are called raga, meaning desire, and dvesha, meaning avoidance, are pretty much the source of the whole thing, you know, the addictions, the clinging, the attachment, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, on the raga end, the pleasure-seeking end, and all the cruelty and anger and general pushing away other people and other races that manifest on the avoidance end. And for people like us who are much more subtle and have done a lot more inner work on ourselves, those threads of clinging and aversion operate quite subtly, especially, of course, in our relationship to ourselves, because we tend to be very attached to and desirous of states that feel good and quite averse to and avoidant of those parts of our experience that don't feel good. And, you know, this, even these very subtle forms of attachment and aversion create the existential suffering that is so much a part of life. And the natural end link in this chain is the intense fear of losing the self that we think we are. And in the yoga tradition, again, this is not news to most of you, most of what we do in our inner work is really about thinning out these kleshas, first in their obvious forms. You know, we work on our anger, we work on our craving, sometimes successfully, sometimes less so. Because the thicker of the accumulation of klesha, the darker our consciousness. And you can experience this moment to moment. I know I have experiences of my consciousness darkening with certain thoughts and lightening up with others. So it's a very good experience to just watch this process. And again, the main way we do this, according to the Yoga Sutras, is by a combination of effort and the cultivation of devotion and surrender. Given that, and given the fact that our fear of dying is layered into the human body and layered into the psyche and is the source of all our smaller fears, at some point it becomes clear to us that what we're really scared of when we are afraid, when we fear dying, is the ego's terror of dissolution. You know, when you have one of those big openings and then you have a contraction, which often happens, you know, after a big opening, there's often a big contraction. It seems to be part of the way energy moves. But that contraction is actually the activity of the ego, and which is protecting itself against dissolving. So, you know, many teachers, especially in the non-dual traditions, say that actual death is no big deal. It's the belief in a separate self that makes us think that dying is going to kill you. So, you know, how many teachers have you heard say, don't worry, your fear of death is just the ego? And, you know, there are times when you really know this in deep meditation or, you know, during a joyful experience, insight, you really get it, you know, when you walk in nature and feel the way you're connected to the redwoods or the ocean or the sky, you know there's no death. You know that your core is bliss. Just the same, and I want to say this, I want to work with this because it is not just the highest teaching, but it is the thing that we must remember as we start to work with some of the specific practices for letting go that connect us to our karmas and our personal issues, both in relationship and relationship to ourselves. We just need to keep remembering the ultimate truth about what causes your fear, which is the belief in a separate self, and to start to embrace the recognition that you are really part of this stream of life that will go on forever. The big reveal as you mature into that recognition is that ego surrender is not going to destroy you, because according to everyone who's gone there, awareness, consciousness survives. So we have the great story of Ramana Maharshi's famous awakening, which, as many of you know, happened when he decided to investigate what death is. And he lay down on the floor and did a practice like similar to the one we're going to do in a few minutes. He imagined his body dead, and being the advanced soul that he was, even at age 16, his visualization soon became a felt experience. He lost all sensation in the body, and then he realized that there was still something alive. There was an I-ness, an awake present consciousness that was there despite the loss of the body. And that was when he began to ask the famous direct path question, who am I? And eventually to the recognition of what he calls the I-I, that is the self that transcends limitation. So let's just take a moment and do a micro meditation on awareness. So you can find your posture. You can do this even if you're driving the car, and you don't have to close your eyes, although I find it's much easier to do when you close your eyes. And we're going to do it as a timed meditation. We're going to do it for just 30 seconds, which is what a micro meditation is. Right now, ask yourself the question, what is it that is aware that I'm listening to these words, that I'm sitting here, that I'm having thoughts, that I'm experiencing this moment? What is it that's aware of that? And then see if you can tune in to that felt sense of awareness. You might find it, lose it, come back to it. Okay. Just take a deep breath. Notice where you are. We'll do it one more time. You're listening to me. You're feeling your body. Thoughts are coming up. Feelings are coming up. Become aware of what's present to all these layers of experience. And relax, as it were. For some of you, that may have been quite revelatory. For others may be going, I don't know what I was supposed to do. And that's fine. We're going to actually take this sense of awareness that we've introduced into the conversation and go on with what I think is one of the most beautiful active meditations I know for letting go. And it's about surrendering the physical elements of the universe, of the body to the universe. It's called the Six Elements Practice. It's a very traditional Buddhist practice. And I think it's really fun. So this is a time when you could lie down in Shavasana if you're in a place where that's possible. And if you do that, if you want to do that, you also might want to pull a blanket or a shawl over you. So I'll give you a moment to do that, and as you do, I'm going to talk about this practice and what it has to do with preparation for dying. One of the very best ways for realizing our fundamental interconnectedness, which brings about a lot of relaxation about letting go of the body, is to start to become aware of what it means that the elements of our bodies are made of the same elements that are in every part of the physical earth. The ancient teachings in the Western traditions, in the Greek tradition, in the Zohar of Judaism, they hold that everything in the physical universe is made of four elements in combination: earth, air, fire, and water, or solidity, fluidity or wateriness, fieriness or heat, airiness or wind. And to this, Indian thought and Chinese thought adds a fifth element, ether or space. And, as most of you know, these elements aren't just physical, they're psychological. We find them in our emotional and feeling states, and this is reflected in our language. So-and-so feels grounded, someone else is spacey, somebody else is all over the place. And, of course, they're very much connected to the chakras. So when the life force begins to leave the body, these elements dissolve, both physically and psychologically. And if you've ever been with a person who was in the act of dying, usually somebody who's dying of a disease or of the processes of old age, you may have seen some of the specific signs that signal this dissolution of the elements. As the earth element in the body, which is the solidity, dissolves, you see that the body becomes more and more inert, becomes hard to move. Often someone will lose feeling in the legs. There's intense heaviness, weakness, feelings of weakness. As the water element dissolves, the mouth and skin dry up. And this is where it's loving for a caretaker to put ice chips or drops of water on the tongue. I always say to my close friends, if you're going to be with me when I die, don't forget the ice chips. And as the fire element leaves the body, the person may spike a fever or get very cold. And then most dramatically, as the air element leaves, the breathing changes. They become very slow and long or raspy. And towards the end, the space after the exhalation becomes longer and longer. And a particular type of breathing called Chain-Stokes breathing signals that death is imminent. And this process can take days or it can take hours. For one of my friend's mother, it actually took the best part of a year, during which she was moving in and out of subtle realms and back into her body, as those of us who were around her watched these signs happening. What actually does happen at death, when the death process really occurs, is that the body literally dissolves into its constituent parts. And here, the Buddhist view of impermanence is really helpful. You know, this body is a collection of cells. I know many of you know this very well, especially if you're a student of anatomy, if you have some medical training. And I want to apologize for my own lack of deep anatomical skill as I describe this process. So, you know, the body is a collection of cells, which is constantly changing. It's also a collection of microbes and viruses that are carrying on processes in every organ that are completely beneath their conscious awareness. And the neuronal system is running things also totally beyond the surface. And this is true psychologically as well, where we believe we are a self because our nervous system is among other things, a mechanism for creating the feeling of coherence between these inner and outer processes and the environment that is actually kind of an illusion. So, and this is, you know, again, it's true in ways that are observable because we each play so many different roles and who we are changes according to the role we're playing at a given moment. You know, you're a different person when you're with your lover than you are at work, at least most of us are. And you're different with your kids than you are with your parents. And at a more immediate level, every mood, every positive or negative thought, especially for those of us who are somewhat emotionally volatile, every new environment we enter actually creates a new experience of self. And if you really notice what's going on as your mental and emotional state changes, you actually can start to see that you have different selves in different situations. So what we call the true self, the capital S self, is not that personal. That personal body-mind we identify with normally. And the deepest practice that lets us stay with recognition of the true self, with awareness, actually asks us to be willing to let go And this is a moment-to-moment practice of identifying with the various roles and moods that normally feel like me, which include, of course, the ones we like and the ones that really suck, the ones that give us a lot of shame and guilt. And to stop identifying is really not the same as not taking responsibility for our actions, which is why the process of learning detachment is such a koan. But the thing is, you know, sickness and death and grief make mincemeat of the roles we've constructed and the armor that we've made to protect ourselves from our very real vulnerability. And, you know, a job loss or the loss of a relationship throws a big monkey wrench into your sense of identity. So this practice is a very good way to relax into the recognition that we're a part of everything. A teacher, a Buddhist teacher named Carol Hyman wrote, if you learn to let go into uncertainty, to trust that your basic nature and that of the world are not different, then the fact that things are not solid and fixed becomes, rather than a threat, a liberating opportunity. So this meditation is an invitation to do a very sensual letting go of the physical elements. So whether you're sitting or lying down, take a couple of breaths and become aware of the weight of your body, your buttocks against the seat, the weight of your whole body against the floor, the weight of your hands against whatever they're resting on. Sense into the solid parts of your body, the bones, the skin. Feel the weight of the skull. The brain, and maybe you can feel into the fingernails, the teeth, the flesh of the gums and the tongue, this is a very sensual, pleasurable feeling that you can sense the organs if you're that sensitive to the inner body, the solidity of the heart. The lungs, the intestines. Really feel into the solid elements in your own body. And now become aware of the solid objects around you, outside your body. The surface you're resting on, its solidity. The floor, the walls, the furniture. Sense the solidity of the building you're in, of the streets around you, and of the soil and the bedrock beneath, the rocks, the gorgeous solidity of the rocks, of the soil. And of the trees, the bark and branches and leaves, the solidity of the plants and of the bodies of birds and animals, the forms all around you in their quality of earthiness, of solidity. And consider that whatever is solid within this body has come to you from outside, starting with the cells of your parents. None of this was you. You grew from the nutrients that came into you from your mother's body. And everything you ate that nurtured you came from outside. They all came from the world. All the solidity in this body comes from some other solid matter in the world. And it's all in the process of returning to the outside world as skin cells are shed, as hairs fall out. So now, offer the solidity of your body into the solidity of the outside world, your bones into the rocks, your organs into the soil, your skin into the leaves. See if you can allow the solidity in your physical body to merge with the solidity outside. Now begin to sense the water element, the fluidity in your body, the saliva, the wetness of the saliva in your mouth, the liquid in your eyeballs. The phlegm in your nostrils, which lubricates your whole body. Of course, the blood that runs like rivers through every part of your body. The sweat under your armpits. And consider the fluidity, the water in your cells. Consider how much of your body is made of liquid. Just tune into the liquidity that you can immediately feel in your body. Now consider the water in the world, the rivers, the oceans, the rain that's coming down all over the West Coast and the snow that may be going on where you are, the moisture in the air. Open to the water in the world. Realize that it's the same water in your body, the same fluidity in your body, whether it takes the form of blood or lymph or saliva. Recognize the connection between the liquidity in you and the liquidity in the world. Now offer the waters of your body, the fluids of your body, into the waters of the world. Have this sense of your inner fluidity merging with the oceans, with the rivers, with the rain, with the lakes, with the underground streams, with the moisture in the air, with the incredible miracle of water that makes this planet alive. Now begin to sense the fire element in your body. The heat. That keeps you stably metabolizing experience. That regulates your temperature. The electricity that runs through your body, sparking the connections between your neurons, communicating through the brain and the rest of the body. Sense the energetic sparkles that you might feel in different parts of you, maybe most intensely in your very active brain, maybe as little ripples of energy in different parts of the body or your skin. Sense the bile system, the energy of combustion that occurs in your digestive organs as it breaks down food. Feel the sheer force of the heating system in your body, how it gives energy and consumes waste. And now consider the fire in the outside world. Right now in the place you are, the heat coming through your radiators, the warm air blowing through the heat registers, and maybe the warmth in the air if you're in the southern hemisphere. The fires burning in forests, in fireplaces, in volcanoes. Consider the electricity, the grid that connects us all around the planet. The electrical element that lets us have this conversation. And above all, consider the sun, the fiery center of the solar system, the heat that both gives us life and destroys it, and the stars and the supernovas. Feel the life-giving and destructive power of fire, its warmth and glow and its potential to dissolve, and offer the fiery elements in your body into the fires outside. Let your body heat merge with the fire in your fireplace, with the electricity in your lamps, and with the sun. Offer the fires in your body to the fires of the world. And now the air. First the breath. flow of breath. What are the qualities of air as touch? So as the breath flows, you can feel it. You can feel it touching every part of you. The gases that you might sense in your bowels, the air that makes you belch and fart, the flow of prana. And as you tune to the breath, feel its connection with the air outside, which it's constantly drawing into your inner world. And then tune into the air. The air that pervades our atmosphere, which is the medium through which birds and insects fly. Sense the power of the wind. Sense how the air holds everything, touches everything, literally caressing you with every breath you take in. And as you exhale, surrender the air element in the body into the air outside. Now sense the space. The space that forms 99% of your cells. The space between your brain and the edge of your skull. The space you experience as your mind when it's quiet. Become aware of the space as the subtle element that holds everything, and surrender the space in your body into the space of the world. And now see if you can become aware of the consciousness that lets you experience all this once again. The aware knowingness that we are told is always present, the part of you that knows you are here. The part of you that hears my voice even if you've fallen asleep. Sense that. Sense the element called consciousness and offer that just for a moment. Imagine that you can let your consciousness, your individual consciousness, dissolve into the vast consciousness that is also you. Can you feel what remains when the elements have dissolved? you might like to open your eyes and rub your hands over those parts of your body that you can reach. Take a big breath. Inhale and exhale. And some of you really might want to stand for a moment and stretch, or just, if you're lying down, sit up and wiggle around. And just take a mental snapshot of yourself at this moment. I want to open the subject of regret because it's come up so much and because it's such an important part of what we're doing here. So I'm going to ask you to hold your questions. And let's say, open up your bandwidth for just a moment. This meditation we've just done is, I find, one of the most skillful kind of big practices for letting go. And again, it's going to unfold for you if you practice it, if you do it once a week while we're here together. It's got a lot of aspects to it, and I find it's actually very cozy as you start to feel into what it really means to be interconnected, to be interdependent. And again, I find there's enormous relaxation in that letting go that we can do through this practice. And as long as we're in this body, we get to work with emotions and we get to work with regret. I want to say a little bit about it, and then I want to give you a practice. Part of the reason that I wanted to talk about it during this class, before we get into the granular discussion of karma, the generalities about it, and of course, yours and mine, is that one of the first things that happens when we start to think about death is that we start to realize what we regret. And even though we're often told that our feelings of regret are teachers, it's sometimes hard to realize why they're such great teachers, why regret is such a great teacher, and why it's so good to start looking at it as we go along, which means getting cozy with the pieces of our personal history that daily events connect to and that sometimes feel raw and unprocessed. And even very advanced practitioners have to do that. And even very advanced practitioners have regrets. One of my friends studied with a famous Zen master in Japan who was a warm and very skillful teacher, a celibate monk who nonetheless had very loving relationships with his students. During his last illness, a few weeks before his death, he looked around the room at some of the students gathered there and he began to cry, "Where is my wife? Where are my children? I'm so lonely. I'm so lonely." When I heard this story, I was shocked because somehow I'd always thought that a master at that level would have transcended those feelings. But as I've aged and, you know, had to deal with some of my own regrets and made, you know, what I hope is some progress, as it were, in working with them, some regret for the road not taken is not only inevitable, but it's not only expectable, but it's actually okay. Because every one of us has to make big choices in life. Some of them are, so to speak, good choices. Some of them aren't such good choices. And sometimes through no fault of our own, stuff we wanted and stuff that we tried for just doesn't work out. You know, maybe because of karmic obstructions, maybe just because of circumstance. And so every one of those choices and every one of those restrictions gives us gifts. Every one involves some sacrifice. And, you know, even though that teacher knew the value of his choice to live as a monk, which had given him a lot of freedom, he'd also missed certain human experiences, and he probably had regretted it off and on for most of his life, and then had to deal with those regrets at the end. Didn't mean they made the wrong choice. It didn't mean his life was meaningless. It's just part of what the human experience is. And, you know, one of the reasons that I wanted to give this course is because my most powerful contemplations over the last year have been about regret and learning to look squarely into my own regrets so that I can come to a place of forgiveness and acceptance. And this is where the welcoming that we talked about in the beginning comes in, because when we allow regrets to surface, when we feel and acknowledge them, ask forgiveness when relevant, it actually becomes possible to accept the regrets and the failures of this life. I mean, let's face it, you know, we've failed some things. And ask forgiveness when relevant, and then we can move beyond them and metabolize them. And this is, in my experience, what peace is all about. For most of us, working with our regrets is not accomplished, obviously, by doing everything right, because some things will never get right. And also because a lot of life is just not in our control. It's accomplished by being willing to work with regret as we go along. And also to recognize that some of the things we feel sorry about actually come from habits and tendencies that you've had for a long time that are part of your karmic backpack in this life. And to recognize also that we're in training. And according to the teachings on karma, that training goes on for many lives. Our hearts get broken and we break other people's hearts. This delicate process of working with regret right now, working with feelings of victimization, working with our emotions as the invitations that they are, involves walking a line where we learn how to touch and feel into our own sadness and also how to hold ourselves back from falling into the swamp of sadness and regret, or the fire of anger. I want to do a very small process now that I'm going to invite you to practice during the course of this week. We can do this practice with the Sushumna Nadi, and I'd like to invite us to do this now with the Sushumna, because part of what we're opening up to in this life is, in this class, is kindling the energies in the Sushumna. I know there's been a lot of practice, and some of you might not be completely energized for another practice, so we're going to make it as light as possible. But I'd like to ask you to choose a situation, a very present and small situation that right now you regret. And I'm talking about something small, like not sticking to your diet, or the fact that you spent an hour reading the New York Times today instead of calling your friend, or a misunderstanding that you had with somebody that where you could have done things better. Just, we're not doing big regrets now. We're just doing small ones. So find a regret from today or yesterday and remember the situation and bring the feeling of regret, which might be a kind of a nagging thing that's been sitting in your consciousness. And that's one reason why working with regret as day by day is so helpful. With presence to the feeling, let go of the story about it. Feel the feeling. Find the place in your body where the feeling is lodged. For most of us, it's pretty much in the heart, maybe behind the eyes. And now become present to the breath sweeping through the central channel, flowing in from above down to the base with the inhalation, flowing upward with the exhalation. You're not trying to be a great meditator in this yamna right now. You're just working with this sweep of breath and opening to the presence of this channel of connection in your central body. And allow your inner body to open up and take in that feeling, that felt sense of regret, as though you're breathing it into the central channel. Inhale it into the central channel. And then with the exhalation, exhale it upwards. And feel the presence of the being above your head. So that the regret is offered into the Shiva presence, the deity presence, the spaciousness above the head. And then breathe in the sense of grace, the sense of light, the sense of love. Breathe it down into your body. And feel it flowing into the particles of regret. You might imagine that the central channel that you're contacting is actually a space that's as large as your body itself. And that, let's call it the bad feeling of regret, can be felt as a little bundle of contraction inside that large inner body. And that with the inhalation, you breathe it in and down the central channel, and with the exhalation, you offer it up into the presence above your head. And then you inhale grace and love into the central channel, allowing it to open up and dissolve the feeling of regret, and then exhale and let it flow back into the region above your head. Now at this point, you may start to actually just be finding yourself meditating in the central channel. There's no content, as it were. But if a naggy thought or another version of that feeling comes up, find the feeling in your body. Let go of the story. Breathe it into the central channel where the breath flows vertically up and down the center of your body. Inhale it into the central channel and exhale it upward as an offering into the spacious presence above your crown. Now with the inhalation, sense the grace flowing downward, flowing through your body and metabolizing whatever aspects of the regret or negative feelings or tiredness or whatever arises. Feeling that inhaled grace, soothing it, offering light and sweetness to it. And then with the exhalation, feel that you're offering back into the light above your head, into the Shiva presence, the deity presence, the grace presence above your head. Whatever part of your body, whether it's your heart energy or the gut energy or the region around your face, each of these has a portal into the central channel. So the more you open the presence of the channel that flows from above down to your base, the more you can begin to inhale those tough and regret-tinged feelings into the central channel, offer them into the presence over your head, and then with the next inhalation, breathe sacred presence down through your body, feeling that it washes the remnants of regret, that it fills your body with presence and grace. And now just let yourself be inside that meditation until with the next inhalation, the energy comes down to the heart. And you simply allow yourself to feel the heart, to feel the grace energy above your head flowing into the heart, and then feel it flowing through your body, as love, as spaciousness, as sweetness. As we close, you might want to bring your hands overhead in prayer position and draw them down around your body, creating that subtle energetic container. That is, we might say, the container for your embodied energy. Thank yourself for all the work you've done tonight. And I suggest you take a couple of minutes to journal, to make note of anything that came up for you that you'd like to record. I also want to suggest that you listen to this call at least once, even a couple of times. The audio will be available tomorrow, as will the homework and some audios of these meditations. Thank you so much for being here. And as we close, we'll be playing again the music that we played at the start of the call, the beautiful rendition of the Mahamrityunjaya Mantra. And you can sit with it or in it, letting the breath flow from above through your body with the inhalation, or letting the breath flow into the heart and expand the heart.
Yajamahe dukkhamiva bandhanani.